Good morning. Welcome to the University of Virginia's Miller Center of Public Affairs for this morning's conference. Those of you who are here have braved the elements and ominous winter storm warnings in order to hear a discussion of an important topic. I think you'll be rewarded for your fortitude, but thank you for coming. I'm here to kind of kick things off very briefly, wearing two hats in a way. The first is as the director of the Miller Center. The Miller Center is devoted to the study of the national leadership of the United States and creating a unique record of that leadership and how America is governed, with a particular focus on the presidency, where we're the leading research center in the country on the presidency. Naturally, that would bring you to in a time of crisis, to the role of executive authority in responding to a crisis while that authority is tempered by or checked by the variety of constraints that we consider essential in a constitutional democracy. We live in times in which that authority is being extended, tested, and constrained, and this is an extremely appropriate subject for public dialogue, and it is highly appropriate that the Miller Center should be a focal point for it here in Virginia. I also come wearing another hat. During much of the time recently, I am in Washington in government service as the director of what's generally called the 9/11 Commission, which is an independent government agency that has been created in order to investigate the facts and circumstances surrounding the attacks upon the United States, broadly defined, and make recommendations for the future conduct of the war on terrorism to be presented next year to the President and to the Congress. I'm not really in a position to preview the conclusions of that investigation, but naturally there is a convergence between my interests as director of the Miller Center and my interest as director of the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission is deeply interested in the subjects that are going to be discussed this morning. In fact, we will be holding a public hearing on the subject of security and liberty on Monday, which will be telecast live on C-SPAN, if you're interested. I think it'll be live on C-SPAN 2 and then recorded on C-SPAN 1. In which we'll hear from former Attorney General Bill Barr, former Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson, and a number of other luminaries. What I'd like to say, in just offering, though, a couple of minutes worth of reflections from the 9/11 experience and from the 9/11 Commission's work, are simply really three comments and themes and observations that perhaps we can keep in mind as the conference this morning unfolds. The first is to unpack what we mean by civil liberties versus national security. In the hearing that we're going to be holding from the point of view of the 9/11 Commission on Monday, we really break down that problem in a very simple way into four parts, each of which are intensely interesting and important. The first part is active, targeted intelligence collection within the United States. What are you prepared to do to gather information from people whom you suspect are engaged in subversion or potential terrorist activities? Active, the challenge of how you draw the lines and set the rules for active, targeted collection of intelligence. But the second problem is routine intelligence collection and sharing of information. Day in and day out, what are you prepared to do in simply canvassing information about citizens about whom you have no particular suspicions? And what do you do day in and day out routinely in sharing information about people? For instance, in such things as watch lists, which is a particular focal point of investigation for the 9/11 story. How do you disseminate information about watch lists? From whom do you derive this information in a routine sense? From private from and for private firms, from and for government agencies of all kinds, because this is very much a federal, state, and local concern. A third important theme is the issue of preventive detention, or detention outside the usual penal framework. For instance, the use of immigration law as a tool of preventive detention. For instance, the use of an enemy combatant designation in order to put people in military detention in a place like Guantanamo or other places. Other way, preventive detention, whether it's for a day or 7 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, what is necessary, permissible, what kind of legal framework can you develop to make those practices sustainable if they are warranted at all? And a fourth key conceptual area is how to think about the problem of organizing the United States government for the conduct of these practices for domestic intelligence. What would be the, what should be the proper role of the CIA inside the United States? What is the proper relationship between federal, state, and local intelligence agencies? I can tell you right now that there are people, there are state and local agencies all over the country that think they are doing counterterrorism intelligence in a big way, whether it's the NYPD or the state of California. This is a vibrant area of federalism. Or the question of whether or not America ought to create an entirely new domestic intelligence agency, supplanting or reallocating the structure of authority that today is centered in the FBI. One could go on, but you can see a conceptual framework that emerges. So that's my first observation, is to unpack the problem. My second observation is to keep in mind the historical pendulum that I think Chuck McCurdy will help us understand better in the remarks that he will make. There is a characteristic tendency in these matters to react violently in response to one or another traumatic development and for the pendulum to swing very hard in one direction. In response, for instance, to abuses of the 40 years, the United States, which had a very elaborate domestic intelligence apparatus, bulldozed it right down to the ground by the mid and late 1970s and early 1980s, and set up a variety of legal constraints. Those legal constraints materially interfered with the investigation of potential terrorist acts in the year 2001, and those legal constraints specifically and materially impeded efforts to apprehend people who would later help fly planes into buildings on September 11th, 2001. So those constraints are not idle academic matters. They were matters that had people in August of 2001 almost screaming at each other, "Can't we do something?" In one case, recorded at the time in notes, an FBI agent saying, "If we don't do something, someone may fly something into the World Trade Center." Yet nothing could be done. So there is a reaction to that. But the reaction to that that we have today, I think, I can safely call today ad hoc. One can say many more things, but I'll reserve them for a later date. And perhaps our speakers will shed some light on what they think of the current framework. So there is a pendulum in these matters, and the way to combat those swings of the pendulum and to develop a sustainable framework year in and year out is to have a historical perspective, which is why, again, Chuck's contribution, but I think all of our speakers will help to give us that kind of broad perspective. And the third observation and comment that I wanted to make in order to open this comment in the conference is to encourage all of you to approach this topic with a sense of modesty about how much any of us know about it. This is not a subject that has been that is well understood by the experts on this subject. Our commission, for example, is the first effort that I know of, certainly in this generation, to actually attempt to make a serious effort to gather empirical evidence on what exactly we do around the country to collect domestic intelligence, literally sending people out to FBI field offices and joint terrorism task forces in cities around America and interview scores of people who work for a variety of government agencies and say, what do you do? What is your job? What do you do all day long? And what do you find works and doesn't work and so forth, actually gather some basis of empirical evidence on which one can make assertions. And my comment is that anyone who inquires deeply into these matters, whether it's that or how does the British system actually work, which is a subject dear to me since I've spent a lot of time on that system and on its operation in Northern Ireland, is anyone who engages in that effort is bound to feel that our understanding of what really goes on here, which is highly limited by the restrictions of classified and classification, we really don't know much about what goes on as a country. And by the way, this is not simply a statement that you should be humble and you should be deferential in acceding to what the government officials say because they know more than you do. In many cases, they do know a lot more than you do, but I'll simply comment that many senior government officials don't know what's going on either, including perhaps in some cases in their own executive departments, because the operational details of these matters are so closely held. In some cases, very senior officials don't have a very good picture of what's going on outside the Beltway either. And if you don't believe that, there are people in FBI field offices all over the country who will tell you their bosses don't know what's going on. They will use stronger words than I have. But the point here is simply to encourage a sense of humility. America is approaching this problem now as it should. It's inquiring into a lot of the basic issues. This is a process that we should engage in and continue, but do so with a sense of humility about how much we know about what's really going on, especially when you try to integrate the foreign dimension of this problem into the considerations of what we want to do domestically, which is characteristically a bifurcation we make in our minds that compromises intelligent thinking about this subject. Beyond those slender observations, I simply want to offer a note of thanks. Thanks to George Gillum, who above all really made this conference happen and brought it to the Miller Center as our new director of special programs here. George's efforts have been terrific. My thanks to all of you, and on behalf of the Miller Center, my thanks to our speakers, who, as I have braved the elements and agreed to work on a Saturday to help us understand this important subject. Thank you all very much, and George, over to you.
Thank you, Philip. I was in my office down the hall here about an hour ago, and Orrin Gross was sitting at my desk working on some final reworkings to his remarks, and the phone rang, and it was somebody who said into the phone, "Is Ken Starr still going to be there?" And of course, Orrin couldn't hear that end of the conversation, and I said, "Oh yes, yes, he's going to be here." And the person said, "All right," and I hung up the phone. Orrin said, "They're calling to see if I made it from Minnesota." So let me briefly describe the format for this conference. The Miller Center has a long tradition that has two prongs on it. One is to permit speakers to fully develop and present their particular argument. We normally allow for each speaker 1 hour. So we have four speakers today, and we're going to ask you all to invest a lot of energy, a lot of fanny fatigue in listening and thinking for 4 hours for four speakers. Each speaker has been asked to speak for about 30 minutes, and then there'll be about 15 or 20 minutes for engagement, dialogue with the audience. For those of you who are in the room, we have people who will pass among you with a microphone to get your questions for the speakers. For those who are in the overflow rooms, we will be passing out cards so they can send their questions in writing. And then every hour after a speaker finishes, we'll take about a 10 or 15 minute break so people can stretch their legs and can discuss what the speakers have talked about. All the speakers will be staying for a little bit after the conference concludes, and hopefully that'll present additional opportunities to engage in exchanges with the speakers. Our first speaker is Charles McCurdy. Chuck got his undergraduate and graduate degrees at San Diego. In between, he spent 2 years at Yale Law School, and he now teaches primarily legal history. He's chairman of the Corcoran Department of History at the University of Virginia and also on the faculty of the law school. His personal scholarship explores the sources and effects of legal change in the United States history. Chuck received recently the most coveted and highly respected award for his in the history business for his recent book, The Anti-Rent Era in New York Law and Politics, 1839 to 1865. He is someone who really every historian in the country considers their teacher, a scholar of the first order, and I am privileged to call my friend, Chuck McCurdy.
My task, as I understand it, is to set the table for the other speakers by saying something about civil liberty and the problem of national security in the American past. My friend George Gillum gave me this title, Restraints on Civil Liberties from the Alien and Sedition Acts to the Present, Historical Contexts. And he said I had 30 minutes. Still, I'll tell some stories, however condensed and however elusive the stories must be, and I'll try over the next 30 minutes to elaborate two themes. The first is a familiar one. During times of national emergency, at times of scary threats from abroad or from within, security concerns have often trumped liberty concerns in ways that Americans subsequently regretted. New and sweeping legislation and or executive orders emerged, new and seemingly sweeping legislation and or executive orders emerged, a fear and anger in the face of danger, a real or imagined, divided the body politic into us and them, government officials, cast a wide drag net, and a great many innocent people got caught up with the guilty. And when affected parties, innocent or guilty, sought redress in the courts, the judicial department tended to defer to the findings of fact and policy made by the political branches and intervened, if at all, only after the crisis had passed. Now, my second theme is maybe less familiar. The second theme is that government lawyers, confronted with each successive emergency, looked hard at the record of the past, not only to avoid the excesses of their predecessors, but also to identify ways to capitalize on the legal options still available in order to meet the crisis at hand. So let me talk about the first, more familiar theme first. Start in February 1799, at the height of the quasi-war with France and the beginnings of the handing down of indictments under the famous or infamous Sedition Act of 1798, James Madison sat down and wrote a remarkable document that he called his Political Reflections. And here's what he wrote. The whole field of political science, rich as it is in momentous truths, contains none that are better established or ought to be engraven on the American mind than the following. That the fetters imposed on liberty at home have ever been forged out of the weapons provided for defense against real, pretended, or imaginary dangers from abroad. That the fetters imposed on liberty at home have ever been forged out of the weapons provided for defense against real, pretended, or imaginary dangers from abroad. And so it happened in World War I, and so it happened in World War II, and so it happened also in the American Civil War, as well as during Madison's own time. We start with the Sedition Act of 1798, which made it unlawful to write, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, or malicious writing against the United States government, the Congress, or the President, with the intent of bringing them or any of them into disrepute. The Adams administration used this act to punish their Jeffersonian Republican partisan enemies. They made 25 arrests, pretty small fry compared to what we're going to get to by the time we get to World War II. There were 15 indictments. There were 10 convictions. In each of the trials, the Jeffersonian defendants argued that the Sedition Act of 1798 was unconstitutional on one ground or another. One ground was that Congress had not been granted any power in Article 1, Section 8 to regulate the press or speech or statements. And second, that the First Amendment barred legislation like the Sedition Act. In each instance, the judges held that the power to prevent sedition, which leads to subversion, was inherent in any national government such as that of the United States. And they pointed out that the freedom of press, which Congress was forbidden to abridge with any law, derived from the common law, meaning only the right to publish without prior consent of government authorities. So all of the arguments about constitutionality failed, and many of the targets of the Federalist prosecutions under the Sedition Act tend to evoke our sympathy and evoke the sympathy even people of that very day. Consider Matthew Lyon, who was a Jeffersonian Republican member of Congress. He was among the victims. He served 4 months in prison for publishing an article and a letter that were sharply critical of President Adams, and he ran for re-election from jail, and of course, the people of his Vermont constituency overwhelmingly re-elected him. Jefferson called that election the election of 1800, the revolution of 1800, and in the aftermath came all of those what will become conventional over the course of American history as national emergencies ceased, as this one, the quasi-war with France, did. Jefferson pardoned all of the men who had been convicted. The Congress appropriated money to repay most of the fines that had been levied under the act. And moreover, a new libertarianism, a link to the First Amendment press clause, began to emerge in the constitutional commentary written by Republicans, most prominently James Madison's Virginia Report of 1800 and St. George Tucker's new edition of Blackstone's Commentaries, the first published as an American edition in the first decade of the 19th century. In New York Times and Sullivan decided in 1965, the Supreme Court, speaking through Justice Brennan, in effect declared the Sedition Act of 1798 unconstitutional in ways that the judges of their own of Jefferson's own time had declined to do, and stated the commitment, the American national commitment, to a robust and open public life, a robust and open public life, which might mean really nasty things said about government and about government officials, nasty things that might hurt deeply. We move to the Civil War. President Lincoln, shortly after the shooting began at Fort Sumter, suspended the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, first in specialized areas, but moving from one specialized area to another until in August of 1862, in a proclamation coming out under his name and the name of Secretary of War Benjamin Stanton, suspended the privilege of the writ throughout the United States, and also provided that if anybody put in preventive detention was actually brought to trial for some offense, that the War Department reserved the right to bring the person to trial before a military commission. As many as 30,000 people were arrested and detained in military custody over the course of the war. And very early in the war, Chief Justice Roger Taney, sitting on circuit in the famous case of Ex parte Merriman, held that President Lincoln's suspension of the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus was unconstitutional. For Roger Taney, it was unconstitutional on the theory that although the Constitution does indeed authorize the suspension of the privilege of the writ during times of insurrection or war to protect the public safety, that power is lodged in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Article 1 is all about the powers of the legislative department of the national government. Article 2, all about the executive powers, confers no authority, mentions nothing about the power to suspend the privilege of the writ. But Congress wasn't in session at the time of Lincoln's initial suspensions, he simply ignored Chief Justice Taney's decision and hoped that Congress might step forward to enact appropriate legislation. But Lincoln's action, coupled with the fact that Congress was not in session, Chief Justice Taney's opinion in the Merriman case, created a kind of dilemma for Congress. On the one hand, if they suspended the privilege of the writ by prospective legislation, it would suggest that Lincoln had no power to do what he had done. On the other hand, if they didn't pass any legislation at all, charges of executive usurpation, charges of arbitrary arrests would have greater political salience. And so, although Congress debated this question just about daily in its special session beginning in July of 1861 and then throughout the entire following Congress, they didn't actually take any action until 1863. On March 3rd of 1863, following a defeat in the off-year elections in 1862, many candidates running against the administration on grounds that a vast number of people had been arbitrarily detained, Congress passed the Habeas Corpus Act of 1863. And the Habeas Corpus Act of 1863 had two basic provisions. First, it authorized the president to suspend the writ and flatly stated that its previous suspensions by President Lincoln were not to give cause for suits against the officers of the United States who had made the arrests. In fact, in a coupling statute, the Indemnity Act, they provided a blanket indemnity against tort suits brought by folks who had been thus detained. But second, the act said that people who were detained, who were arrested by the Lincoln administration, this 30,000 persons, were to be processed in some way. And they had 90 days to decide whether or not to give them a loyalty oath and let them go, or taken before a federal court and have them indicted for some offense against the United States. The Lincoln administration's response to the enactment of this statute, embedded primarily in the work of the Judge Advocate General in the United States Army, a man named Joseph Holt, a very fine lawyer, was to say, we don't want trials. We don't want indictments. If we decide to punish anybody, as opposed to just detain them, we'll go after them with a military commission under our proclamation of August 1862. Well, after the war was over, in Ex parte Milligan, decided in 1867, the Supreme Court ruled that in areas where civil courts were open and functioning, it was unconstitutional to try civilians for treason or for a conspiracy to give aid and comfort to the enemy by a military commission. Four justices said that what had happened in the Milligan case, a prosecution for treason for conspiracy to in Indiana to take control of a United States armory and then march south to join the Confederate lines. acts of that sort were barred. Prosecutions for acts of that sort by military commission were barred by the Habeas Corpus Act of 1863. They were supposed to have been taken before a federal magistrate. But the other five judges went further and rested their opinion instead on the Sixth Amendment, the right to trial by jury of the Constitution. And the court, speaking through Justice David Davis, Lincoln's old campaign manager in 1860, seemed to recognize that whatever might be the constitutionality of actions taken in time of war, the exigencies of wartime might foreclose careful weighing of the tension between security and liberty. As he put it, during the late wicked rebellion, the temper of the times did not allow calmness and deliberation and discussion, but once the public safety had been assured, questions like that decided by the court could, were aired and decided, as he put it, without passion. Now, World War I brought another test of the country's willingness to protect civil liberties in time of war. The Espionage Act of 1917, as amended and made more draconian with the Sedition Act provision in 1918, made it a crime to willfully utter, print, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the American form of government, the Constitution, the flag, the military forces or uniform, or to use any language intended to bring any of these things or persons into contempt, scorn, contumely, or disrepute. This looks a lot like the Sedition Act of 1798, doesn't it? Over 2,000 defendants were prosecuted under the Espionage Act. Among those actions deemed by prosecutors to be threats to the national security under the act were statements of religious objections to the war, suggestions that the draft was unconstitutional, criticisms of the Red Cross and of the YMCA. It was in this period that that we ceased to call sauerkraut. Americans had to call it liberty cabbage. The teaching of German in private schools was prohibited in many states, Iowa, Nebraska. In Schenck against the United States, decided in 1919, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, mindful of the importance of free expression in our constitutional system, articulated the famous clear and present danger test. As to war, however, Holmes said, when a nation is at war, many things that might be said in time of peace will not be endured so long as men fight. And in the Schenck case and its companion cases, Schenck was a socialist who distributed leaflets in the streets of Philadelphia, calling upon those who read the leaflets to join the Socialist Party and our fight against this unconstitutional draft. Those were the action words. The cases decided that day were a case involving a man named Froerich, who was a German language newspaper editor in St. Louis, and Eugene Debs, who'd been the socialist candidate for president and got 1 million votes in 1912, but in 1918 he was prosecuted under the Sedition Act for giving speeches denouncing the war in which there were people of draftable age present. And the court upheld the convictions in all three instances under this clear and present danger test. The war was over by the time Abrams in the United States reached the United States Supreme Court in October of 1919. And it was in that instance that the famous Holmes-Brandeis view of the First Amendment, a much broader conception both philosophically and in terms of application of a clear and present danger test, was articulated in Holmes's dissenting opinion. Brandeis joined him in that dissent and himself made some rather remarkable statements laying the foundations for what a modern legal scholar, Harry Calvin, called a worthy tradition of First Amendment liberty in the 1920s. And also in the aftermath of World War I came the creation of the American Civil Liberties Union. and the ACLU and its activities and the activities of new free speech advocates on the bench and in the law schools. It really transformed American ideas about civil liberties between World War I and World War II. For example, those statutes that prohibited the teaching of German in private schools were declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in the early 1920s. And by 1940, lawyers from the American Civil Liberties Union and from the American Bar Association could stand together shoulder to shoulder in cases like the Jehovah Witness flag salute cases and cases in which mayors prohibited the use of public streets for parades and the like were declared by unconstitutional by the Supreme Court with amicus briefs created by those two very different sorts of organizations. But then came the day that shall live in infamy, as Franklin Roosevelt said. And World War II brought the issue of the loyalty of Americans of Japanese descent to the fore. And soon after the outbreak of the war, President Franklin Roosevelt issued an executive order aimed at safeguarding the country against espionage and sabotage. And his order provided that certain military commanders might designate military areas from which any or all persons could be excluded. And of course, the principal military area was the entire Pacific coast, and the people who were excluded from the entire Pacific coast were all persons of Japanese descent, whether they were aliens or citizens of the United States. But in Korematsu against the United States, decided in 1944, the court upheld Korematsu's conviction for violating that military exclusion order. And Justice Hugo Black, one of the greatest civil libertarians ever to sit on the Supreme Court of the United States, declared that any legal restriction curtailing the civil liberties of a single racial group was immediately suspect and must be subjected to the most rigid scrutiny. But in this case, Black concluded that the military order should be sustained, along with five of his colleagues, because of pressing public necessity. Rebuffing the claim that the exclusion of those of Japanese ancestry was based on prejudice against that group, Black accepted the argument that Korematsu had been excluded from that zone because, as he put it, we are at war with the Japanese Empire, because the properly constituted military authorities feared an invasion of our West Coast and felt constrained to take proper security measures, because they decided that the military urgency of the situation demanded that all citizens of Japanese ancestry be segregated from the West Coast temporarily, and finally, because Congress, reposing its confidence in this time of war in our military leaders, as inevitably it must, determined that they should have the power to do just this. But with the passage of time, it's become increasingly clear that persons of Japanese ancestry on the West Coast did not, in fact, present much of a security threat. A congressional commission said as much in 1993. And long before that, Presidents Carter and Reagan had apologized, and Congress had enacted a statute that not only tendered apologies, but also reparations for the harm inflicted on American citizens of Japanese ancestry during World War II. So once again, we have the familiar pattern: abridge liberty for national security, divide the body politic into us and them, and then in the aftermath of war, acknowledge error, rebuild institutions, and go on. Let me take up my second theme, which I can do a little more briefly. This one focuses on the way government lawyers confronted with each successive emergency looked hard at the record of the past, not only to avoid the excesses of their predecessors, but also to identify legal options still available to meet the crisis at hand. Consider first the Alien Act of 1798, which is conventionally coupled with the Sedition Act. I've separated them to make different points about each one. The Alien Act of 1798 provided, among other things, that it shall be lawful for the President of the United States during any time during the continuance of this act, and that's the time specified was 2 years, to order such aliens as he shall judge dangerous to the peace and safety of the United States, or shall have reasonable grounds to suspect are concerned in any treasonable or secret machinations against the government, to depart out of the territory of the United States. So fearful of French people, of French-speaking aliens within the United States during the quasi-war with France, prompted Congress to vest the president with the authority to detain and then to deport persons of any nationality other than that of the United States. Now, aliens who were detained and then ordered to leave the country might, under the act, under the president's discretion, be granted a license, as the act put it, a license to remain upon demonstrating to the satisfaction of the president by evidence to be taken before such persons or persons as the president shall direct that they posed no danger to the United States. Well, James Madison, in a famous letter to Jefferson, called the Alien Act a monster that must forever disgrace its parents. For Jeffersonians, the Alien Act was unconstitutional. Jeffersonians claimed that the Constitution authorized Congress only to naturalize aliens. It conferred no power on them to detain, let alone to deport, with aliens without due process of law. Federalists, on the other hand, much as they had done in the Sedition Act debate, claimed that the national government's power of aliens was inherent in a national government, recognized by the law of nations, practiced by other national states, and therefore was altogether unfettered by the right to trial provisions and other prophylactic provisions of the Bill of Rights. Now, the Alien Act expired by its own terms in June of 1800, and it was not reenacted. But the inherent powers doctrine that Federalists articulated on the floor of the House and Senate and in their newspaper press and pamphlets was revived. And it was revived in 1888 in a landmark Supreme Court that sustained the constitutionality of the Chinese Exclusion Act, passed in 1882, and the process of government restriction of immigration, and then linked to that, of course, the power to deport illegal aliens, began under the auspices of that inherent powers doctrine in that year. 5 years later, in a famous case called Fong Yu Ting against the United States, a deeply divided court, 4-3, and people among the three dissenters were constantly writing letters trying to get the two guys who were away from the bench back to Washington so maybe they could have a 5-4 to overrule Fong Yu Ting the following term. In that case, the court held that the national government's plenary power to detain and to deport aliens was not constrained by the Fifth Amendment or by other liberties safeguarded by the Bill of Rights on the theory that deportation was not punishment and procedures linked to deportation were therefore not trials within the meaning of the first of the Bill of Rights. Now, during World War I, Congress found a new use for this legal tool. They identified its use to suppress the political radicalism of many aliens, many immigrants in the United States. And the result was the Alien Act of 1918, which in turn generated A. Mitchell Palmer's deportation delirium during the Red Scare of 1919 to 1920, a Red Scare which saw the deportation from the United States of hundreds of political radicals, including people like Emma Goldman, who were just philosophical anarchists and found themselves suddenly in the Soviet Union. Consider next the Articles of War, enacted by Congress and signed into law by President Thomas Jefferson in 1806. Now, the Articles of War specified offenses that were cognizable by courts martial or military commissions, and most of them dealt with offenses committed by members of the American Armed Forces. But one article, traceable all the way back to 1806, specified prosecution by military tribunals for spies. And during the Civil War, the list of civilian offenders, given the context of a civil war, all of those potential offenders were citizens of the United States. So during the Civil War, the list of civilian offenders that became subject to military jurisdiction grew to include not just spies, but also guerrillas and bushwhackers and people who, in the specific theater of war, and pre-warned by a general or special order issued by a military commander of the district that gave aid or comfort to the enemy, those people became violators of the rules of war and subject to prosecution through court-martial or military commission. Now, in the Milligan case, even Justice David Davis's five-justice majority acknowledged, albeit in obiter dictum, that such persons were subject to trial by military commission, and they distinguished Milligan's situation from on the grounds that he had been prosecuted for treason and been prosecuted for acts that were committed outside the theater of war itself. Now, during World War II, government lawyers settled on the opinion, settled on that option to deal with the German saboteurs who came ashore in separate landings in New York and Florida. They came ashore in German uniforms. They hid their uniforms. They changed into civilian clothes, and they fanned out across the country. In an ex parte querin, the Supreme Court held that the saboteurs had acted as belligerents, not in military uniform, and therefore they lacked the protection that would ordinarily be accorded to prisoners of war. Moreover, the acts charged against the prisoners in the Quirin case also took them outside the constitutional protections normally accorded in criminal proceedings, such as the right to trial by jury, because they had acted as belligerents, not in uniform, within a theater of war. And those men, those Nazi saboteurs, were executed by order of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, just as government lawyers invoked Congress's plenary power over aliens in the World War I era, and government lawyers invoked military jurisdiction over saboteurs under the Articles of War in the World War II era, so the government lawyers of our own day have fused those options and a good deal more into the Patriot Act. As I understand it, the principal objectives of this morning's session are to discuss whether the Patriot Act is a prudent measure, and second, to discuss how we should understand the measure relative to conventional constitutional norms. As we do so, I suggest that we keep firmly in mind the Madisonian truth that I quoted at the outset. The Madisonian truth, again, is that the fetters imposed on liberty at home have ever been forged out of the weapons provided for defense against real, pretended, or imaginary dangers from abroad. Thank you very much.
Who would like to ask the first question? Let me ask, when you ask a question, would you please state your name, because we are both recording for later rebroadcast and also webcasting now these proceedings, and it's helpful for people who are not in the room to know who it is that's asking the question.
Yes, my name is Peyton Weary. I would like to suggest that possibly there's something quite different going on today that has not been true in the past. Philip Zelikow used the term war on terrorism. Is this really a war? And if so, when is it over? Is it over in 1 year, 5 years, 20 years, 100 years? Terrorism has been going on in this country and worldwide for hundreds of years. And so when is the war over? And when are these prisoners in Guantanamo that are being held incommunicado being going to be released? When will they be repatriated if there's no end to the war? So we have not declared, is this really a war? We've talked about, I think war has been used kind of loosely. We talk about the war against kitchen odors or the war against lead paint. Is this really a war or is it a campaign? And if it's a campaign, then possibly what you've been talking about may be quite erroneous.
Well, it was the American Civil War was a war. It too was undeclared. We had a better idea of when it started. It started with the firing at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, and Lincoln's request for troops. But when did it end? The Supreme Court said in a case called Stewart and Kahn, after it had ended, that the war didn't end simply with the surrender of the Confederate troops. It didn't end, said the court, until such time as such safeguards had been established to ensure that it wouldn't be, that it would not be resumed, and that the fruits of the Union victory had been secured. And in that sense, the Civil War kept going on for a very long time. Indeed, representatives from the state of Texas were not reseated in either the House of Representatives or the United States Senate until 1872. So we do have some precedents to help us think about that, but the answers to the other questions you asked, when is the war on terror going to end? What's going to happen and when to the folks at Guantanamo Bay? You're asking the wrong guy.
Well, you know, these people have families. They have children. They could be held for 20, 30 years without trial, without any ability to have legal counsel, to be rotting in prison for the rest of their lives. Is this really something that we want to have happen? And what is this going to do to the image of the United States worldwide? We already have enough trouble with the image of the United States worldwide. If this information gets out that we're holding these people indefinitely, I think it's a very bad thing to happen.
Dr. Weary, Professor McCurdy, I think, has done a good job of putting that question in historical context. And if I may, I'll ask if you will re-ask that question of one of the speakers who's more immediately involved with the current situation. John, there's a gentleman right in back of you against the wall up there who is next.
Thank you. My name is David Springman, and I'm a former student of Dr. McCurdy, who probably doesn't remember it. I wonder if you would make a few comments about the post-World War II period of McCarthyism and the House Un-American Activities Committee and those kinds of activities and the climate of that time.
So that we're not talking about a hot war, but we're talking about a cold war, which led it with the outbreak of fighting in Korea into a hot war. And for roughly 10 years, we had an array of loyalty security measures, a number of prosecutions under another statute passed under an inherent powers to protect the National Existence Act, the Smith Act. And when all those judges who were, most of them Roosevelt and Truman appointees, steeped in the Holmes-Brandeis idea of freedom of speech, the notion that the danger must be imminent and that speech must have its due, held in the case of the United States and Dennis in 1951, that we should really understand the clear and present danger idea in terms of the gravity of the evil overthrow of the government of the United States by force and violence by communists. The gravity of the evil discounted by its probability, which of course resulted in decisions that affirmed the conviction of the sort of first string communist leaders. By 1957, the temperature had changed some. McCarthy had been censured by the Senate. And then we started to get some Supreme Court opinions beginning in the Yate case. Some new scholarship suggesting that once again we had probably overreacted between 1948 and 1955 or 56 and that it was time to restore the worthy tradition of American civil liberties. So in some ways, the Cold War period, at least the early Cold War period, and its impact on civil liberties is comparable to that of the other four incidents that I focused on in my talk this morning.
There's a lady right
here. Rosemary Hayes, my Chuck. The thing that concerns me is this is the first time we have dealt with that holding people when they didn't weren't on the United States land. All the things that you talked about, it were people who were in the United States. In this case, the people were taken from one place to put into another non-American place, and yet we're doing what they, based on, is it based on what you told us this morning?
Well, it's not the first time. And I can't remember all the facts of the case, but I bet both of these gentlemen can. What's the 1952 case? The Germans who kept on fighting and were captured in Shanghai? Yeah. Under the Quirin Doctrine that I talked about the Nazi saboteurs, the court with very little difficulty was able to deny a habeas corpus and to sustain the conviction of those guys who were actually captured in Shanghai. And where was the trial? Was the trial actually? The trial was in Germany. So it's not the first time, Rosemary. There are all these things that we tend to forget about between wars, but the lawyers never forget.
My name is Louis Valenti. One of the things that you discussed was this idea of we do things and then we regret it. We do things, then we regret it. What advice would you give to keep us from getting to the point where we regret it after this whole episode is over?
Keep holding forums like this. Keep thinking about it, and keep demanding the most prudent possible behavior of our elected officials while the crisis, as the crisis continues.
Chuck, may I ask a question? That is, do you see over the last 200 years a continuing contraction of civil liberties, or do you think that there was sort of a golden age where the American civil liberties cup was full, and if so, when would that have been?
That's a complicated question because of changes in the constitutional order itself brought about by the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and then the putting of those amendments to new uses in American constitutional law beginning in the 1920s. I guess my short answer to that question would be there is no golden age. For the most part, setting aside these periods of emergency, these periods in which security interests trumped liberty interests for particular periods of time, I would say that the basic trajectory of individual liberty in the United States, especially independent liberty protected by a rule of law, has actually been on an upward trajectory from the American Revolution to the present. So think of it this way, with all of these sort of spikes downward. I wouldn't want to defend that in print, but I'll say it at the Miller Center for Public Affairs.
Bob O'Neill, on the question of living to regret, Chuck, my recollection is that shortly before his death, Justice Black actually did publicly express a sense of chagrin, at least, if not shame, about Korematsu. So maybe that's a lesson that we should cite more often. My question has to do with what guidance you draw from history on the question of
the civil liberties of lawfully resident aliens. Right on the eve of World War II, you have the Supreme Court treating Harry Bridges, who was not a U.S. citizen, though lawfully resident for a long period and the head of a major labor union, as though he enjoyed the full First Amendment rights of a citizen. And then you have contrasting views. What consistency, if any, do you get from history on a question that is obviously critical these days, the civil liberties, including but not limited to First Amendment rights of lawfully resident aliens?
Once again, I think that's an up and down one. The early cases after Fong Yuting in the United States was decided was a British anarchist now who came to visit the United States named Turner. Now, John Turner was not, like Harry Bridges, a longtime resident alien. He was a visitor, but he was deported pretty fast as soon as it was determined that his purpose in the United States was to give some speeches endorsing the general strike. My guess is that if Turner had wanted to give those speeches in the United States in 1965 as opposed to 1905, he wouldn't have been hassled at all, although Fong Yuting and its principles and many of the underlying statutes were still around.
There's a gentleman over here and then Mr. Turner.
My name's Leo Cohen. Have there been political rather than national security motivations through history for some of these, what can you call them, predispositions toward giving up our liberties?
They're difficult to disentangle. If you ask the Federalists, members of the Federalist Party in 1798, what's this about? This is about national security, right? You ask the Jeffersonian Republicans, they'd say, this is all about politics. Look who they're arresting, right? In the Civil War, the us and them were Northerners and Southerners. Unionists and Confederates. So it sort of depends on who you ask within a context, and because of who you ask in a context, it seems to me that insofar as we can derive a historical lesson from such episodes, it is that partisanship or politics tends to get entangled in ways that are difficult to disentangle in the application of statutes bearing upon liberty in times of national emergency. So that's what counts for my response to the question from the gentleman at the back, you know, what should we do in these kinds of situations? Act prudently and hold administrations to account to reduce the incidence of politically motivated deleterious effects on civil liberties as much as one possibly can in such an during periods of emergency.
Bob, let me ask you to do the last question.
Thank you, Bob Turner. It seems to me on a more positive note that things have gotten better. If you look at the history of Lincoln and Wilson and Roosevelt, as you've pointed out, one big difference between those situations and the current one is the president immediately went to Congress, which has the primary authority for restricting the freedom of the people, and got a statute passed overwhelmingly that may well have gone too far in some areas and thus included a sunset provision, so it will have to be reenacted after some time. Virtually all of the major things that are being criticized were not, as opposed to earlier examples, done by presidents by executive order, but were done by authority of Congress, which is exactly as it should be. As for the war being an undeclared war, it really isn't in any meaningful sense. In Bass versus Tingey and Talbot versus Seaman, the Supreme Court held that Congress could authorize hostilities without formally declaring war. Congress has done that in this case overwhelmingly. So I would say on balance, while certainly when you're trying to balance, you know, the Fifth Amendment is not alphabetical. It says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. But life is listed first, and we really are in a setting where the government has to balance trying to protect the lives of Americans who are under attack, at the same time protecting the liberty of all Americans, and you can't always, you know, have a full dose of both. So I'm not saying they've made the perfect choice, but I think they deserve to be commended for having done the proper process of going to Congress and saying this is our problem and having Congress pass a statute that can be modified as time goes on and we see if we've made mistakes.
Let me provide a gentle reminder that this is sort of like Jeopardy. Statements have to be in the form of a question. Thank you very much, John. We'll take about a 7-minute break and then come for our second speaker.
And property to do, but oh no, no, this was a one-shot deal. Well, I thought by having those two themes, I thought the first one, but
give your mic to John. Here it is.